Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 98, nearly approaching that 100 mark.
Centennial.
Of the Alexis Yourself podcast. And then episode 99 will be recorded Rope Tackle in Shoreham next week, all sold out. I'm going to fly into the Shoreham Aerodrome because site of the crash a few years ago. I'm going to travel down to Shoreham in my own MiG 21.
Are you flying out from the historic Croydon airport?
I'll fly out from, they'll clear High Holborn and give me a straight run.
From High Holborn?
I'm going to fly from High Holborn. I'm in my own, like John Travolta, in my own MiG 21. Just short takeoff, go to reheat as soon as I'm off the ground.
Reheat?
So vertical takeoff. I'm going to fly and then I'm going to land at Shoreham Airport to do the rope tackle show that night. So that'll be exciting.
Whoa, MiG 21 looks crazy. It's got a big pointy nose.
Yeah.
What's the point of that? Is that to catch geese? Is that
to direct the air around the air intake?
Super streamlined.
The air intake is right at the front rather than the sides in more modern jet aircraft. The air intake in the MiG 21 was right at the front.
Can that thing land and
no
vertically?
No.
It doesn't hover.
It does not hover. The only Soviet jet that hovered was the Yak-28, I think it was, which looked a bit like a Harrier, but actually had separate engines for takeoff and lateral flight.
Fascinating.
It wasn't a huge success, I think. But yeah, so that's how I'm going to land. This John, I think John Travolta lives in one of these because he's got a huge collection. There are housing estates in the United States that have, landing strips. They have runways rather than
a driveway.
Driveways or roads. So you have your planes stored in a hangar and then you drive onto the runway and take off from your house.
Has he had a near, did he have a plane crash?
As far as I know he can fly. Like, I don't know whether he's type approved to fly like a 747 and stuff, I think.
Fuck me. Mate, if I was rich, I would definitely learn to fly. Like, that's the, what a use of your money, to learn how to fly a plane.
You have to be very rich. So it's very expensive. I actually once, when I was flying to the States, the guy next to me was, it was from the, not the F, whatever, the CAA, I think the approval body for aircraft in this country, New Zealand, to the States. I can't remember why. So we had a very interesting, but he said they're very reluctant to approve the private use of fighter jets. Cause he said in the States, he said, if you have a problem, you're over Aberdeen in your Lightning 1960s fighter jet. But if something goes wrong, by the time you crash, you're in Brighton, So it's, they go so far.
Oh, is that why?
Yeah. So he said, it's such a small country that really they don't generally allow people to have single engine fighters or whatever.
I was thinking more like if someone has a gun and they lose their mind and they kill some people. But like if you owned a fucking fighter jet, the damage you could do.
Yeah. I don't think you'd ever get approval for weapons. But but even so, yes, as I said, you know.
Right. They move that fast. They really do. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's mad.
So they were reluctant. I don't know if people are allowed to. Well, that was that Hunter that crashed at Shoreham, which is in 1950s. Hawker Hunter, I think. That was privately owned, I think. So it is allowed. And that killed a number of people on the road, the road that runs up through Shoreham.
Hunter. Was that a fighter jet as well?
Yeah, so 19 British fighter jet.
So did the Brit? You always complain about, it's not as impressive looking, the Hunter. It's a bit, I like the curves on it though. It's a curvy little thing.
Yeah, it sold well. It sold well. I think it was during the time British.
Is that a bomber?
No, it's a jet fighter. It may be able to be to it's bomb, got the, you know, to
it's got the body
precision bombing as well. But it was essentially a fighter. interceptor.
I've got a monitor, so if people watching at home, you see me looking to the right, I can now Google stuff on a separate screen. Mm. I've got a little monitor here on my right. So now I can look at all these fucking army planes that you keep talking about. You complain that, you know, the British made, you know, naval ships and planes, they all fall apart nowadays. Yes. And they're useless. But we used to be the gold standard, or not?
Yeah, in some areas. I mean, the Centurion tank of this has gone in a direction I didn't expect, but the Centurion tank, for instance, of the 19, and British tanks during the Second World War were pretty terrible, but the Centurion that came right at the end of the war was really the best, certainly the best Western tank of the sort of 1950s. I think our fighter jets were fine. But at that time, Britain was spending 10% of GDP on military equipment. And so, you know, the money was there too. I mean, still a lot of it was squandered, like having three separate V bombers. I think it was insane. So it was still, there was still a massive over, I guess, corruption and you know, misappropriation of resources. So,
what's wrong with having three bombers?
You don't need three different bombers to essentially do the same thing. Don't know. Oh, right. Disagree with me, listeners.
Oh, three different bombers.
Yeah,
the Vulcan. They had multiples of each one, right? Surely.
Yeah. That's okay. Right. But they had the three different, entirely different models.
They put your focus
Victor,
on one thing.
The Vulcan and the, whatever the third one was called.
Wow.
But yeah, I think, you know, I think we'd reached the peak of kind of efficiency in producing arms by the end of the Second World War, but then that kind of went away again in the 60s. Should we
do the podcast?
Yes, that was
press record now, shall I?
that was intensely pleasurable for me. I don't know if it how it felt to the listeners. I could go on about the British main battle rifle as well. Maybe we'll do that on another show. The FNFAL.
You know about Croydon Airport?
There used to be the main airport for London. Yeah. The airport sort of hotel or the airport building is still there, isn't it? You go drive through Croydon.
Yeah, it was Britain's first terminal control tower. But it looks cool. It's got this Art Deco building and there's plane.
It's lovely, yeah.
I've always wondered what the hell that plane was doing there. And then just, I think there was an article in the Times this week about it.
Yeah.
Intriguing.
I think like Amy, you know, Amelia Earhart and people flew from, and Amy Johnson flew from.
Amy Johnson.
Yeah.
She was the first woman to fly solo to Australia.
Yes.
Maybe we could visit and do a video there.
Yes. Not that much. I always used to like Croydon. We used to see Croydon from sort of South London, and it was a very rare cluster. This is in like the 80s or something. A very rare cluster of tower blocks, and, you know, which was unusual because you only had like the City of London, and then you had Croydon, which was. I used to think of that line from the Stevie Wonder song. He says, "New living for the city, you know, New York, just like I pictured it, skyscrapers and everything." I used to think Croydon, just like I pictured it, skyscrapers and everything. But it was quite a sight, Croydon, seen from a distance.
From a distance.
In the 80s. Yeah, well, I'm, you know.
I used to be terrified of it as a kid because you'd hear horror stories. It's really rough, you know. It had their reputation for being really rough. But I've had some great nights out there now. You know,
it's got some nice bits, hasn't it, Croydon?
Yeah. It's got some great culture and nightlife. They call it the Cronks.
The Cronks, really?
Yeah.
Just outside Croydon, I once bought a very disappointing tandoori chicken. Still, you can see it still burns now. I bought this tandoori chicken. I think I might have even got a parking ticket as well for buying. I guess we were driving to Brighton or something on the surface roads and just outside Croydon. So tandoori chickens and cheap. And we parked, had it, and it was really disappointing. So anyway, should we?
Yeah.
After that thrilling segment, what's our next segment?
This is...
Hey, what's been grinding your gears this week, Alexei? Yeah, we haven't done that in a while.
My gears, yeah. Is, well, let's stick Keir Starmer. Linda got a, sent me a really interesting quote from somebody, I think on Twitter or X, where it's called now. Somebody called the Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao Institute. They sound like good people. And this was really good. Keir Starmer yesterday, in order to try and divert attention from his terrible Labour Party plotting against him. He's disinterred ID cards again. And Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao Institute, they say this has nothing to do with immigration whatsoever, because he said it was about immigration. Just as it had nothing to do with terrorism when Blair proposed it, and nothing to do with football violence when Thatcher first floated it. This is another power grab by the security services and a chance for dodgy tech companies to milk cash out of the state for a project that will go billions over budget. It must be opposed by everyone who values free speech and basic democratic rights. I think that's a very good point. I mean, just that it is one of these fucking things that they kind of they drag out from time to time.
Yeah. So they're using immigration, which is the hot button topic at the moment, which seems to have a lot of people behind this anti-immigration sentiment. So they're using that to try and help them.
As an excuse to launch this fucking ID card.
No, but to help get support for it, you know, dissuade any people who would say otherwise that this is a bad idea.
But to point out that it was, you know, it's been brought in, you know, floated before and wants to stop football violence.
Exactly.
It's
really
terrorism. It's a really,
really well done to highlight that.
I mean, that fucking man, honestly.
Digital ID cards. So, you know, what would be the harm of a digital ID card for everyone?
I don't know. That was because it was a big thing after, because people that had ID cards during the war, and it was a big thing afterwards to get rid of them. And there's footage of people burning their ID cards and saying, no, we are British. You know, it's not in our tradition to have ID cards. And it was one of the kind of central planks of the post-war, the immediate post-war, that we no longer had to have ID cards because it was no longer necessary. And I think that's as true now as it was then, really. But I mean, just fucking Starmer. I'm sorry I voted for him. No, I didn't vote.
You can't burn a digital ID card, can you?
No, you can't. That's true. But it also will. But, you know, you think of, I was just, because I was watching a clip somewhere about people talking about they cover these things up, but there was a Fujitsu, who of course also were responsible for the post office Horizon scandal. They'd also been brought in to do a kind of to do the NHS IT, and that went £12 billion over budget. £12 billion over budget. Oh, and I think Linda was saying there was maybe that they're going to give the contract to Palantir as well, because we were deeply embedded in the Israeli genocide. And one of their founders, Peter Thiel, is a raving.
For fuck's sake. We don't need them. We've already got everything you need to know about me. It's already accessible by the government. My card, credit card information, my picture, my address.
Yeah.
It's so unnecessary. So... absolutely. Just, you've got to think someone's profiting out of this.
What? Yeah, yeah. And it's about, I mean, I think it's partly just a distraction, just something to say on the day when he was being attacked by Andy Bannon, but also, yeah, trying to shift the news focus. But also, yeah, I just say to people, you know who I am, just get a book about 1980s comedy.
And what is this Burnham beef? Can you shed any light on that for me?
Well, not a great deal. That's why I was thinking that. I mean, Keir Starmer is failing massively. He is massively hated. And, you know, he's going to lose the country to reform. And so people on the left of the party are floating Andy, you know, ask Andy Burnham. It does seem kind of personable. I mean, he's not. If you remember him when Jeremy won the leadership, he was just another empty suit mouthing neoliberal platitude. So he's learned it. But he has he's had a good, you know, the Hillsborough law, the Hillsborough campaign, and also the Manchester Arena bombings. He was impressive as a person during those. So I suspect he's a much more decent person than Starmer, who's terrible. But
it's not difficult.
Yeah, I don't know whether the faction around Starmer is that they would. I think because they're so right wing. I'm not in the Labour Party, but they seem they control the levers of power. So you know, they would rather have Wes Streeting as their anointed candidate. So I don't know whether Burnham can. I mean, I guess the membership would support him, but they, you know, as we saw during the Corbyn years, they don't matter. So.
Who looks at Wes Streeting and thinks theirs are next leader?
Yeah, with his film star good looks. But they're flailing around, really. But I mean, to segue into your party shenanigans, it would be if Burnham did somehow get the leadership of the Labour Party, he would at least on the service move it to the left. I think he would presumably accept back, you know, people who had been expelled. And he may even have, of course, offered. I mean, something I don't understand, really. I mean, I was talking to somebody who knows him well, or works with him. So he's still in grief and anger about being expelled from the Labour Party. Why you would be angry about being expelled from that hateful organisation, I don't really know. But they're all those left MPs like MacDonald or Clive Lewis who stay in the Labour Party, that they seem to have this affection for it, which I find inexplicable. And I think Jeremy still does. And so it would be a sort of, it would perhaps affect the, you know, because people are partly interested in your party because the Labour Party has moved so far to the right. If I don't think Burnham would substantially alter the reality of the Labour Party, but it might alter the tone, as it were. So he would accept left wingers back. He would maybe be a bit more, you know, a bit less supportive of the Israeli genocide and so on and so forth. So that might be a problem for your party. The people would, you know, best of the devil, you know, and stuff. It would be, people might be moved to, but so I.
And he's not a posh twat.
No. Well, neither Streeting or Furness, but I mean, So I don't know whether he could get the leadership of the Labour Party. I think it would be a complicated, as if there aren't enough complicating factors already, it would be a fairly complicating factor for the nascent political left party at the moment known as your party.
Well, how many times did the Tories change leadership without losing
Boris,
power?
Boris, who came after Boris? Was it Liz Truss after Boris? And then
briefly, yeah.
Rishi Sunak and then Kemi Badenoch. So, I mean, but that's one of the reasons that they're in the electoral doldrums, isn't it? Because they've changed leaders. The public apparently does not like that, really. So changing leaders does not sit well with the voting public, apparently.
This new part, your party.
Yes, your party. Well, yeah, it's not, it's been a troubled period. We're all very excited. I mean, obviously everybody, so many people were excited about it. Now they feel a bit sick.
Yeah.
I was one of the shenanigans.
People who, as soon as I saw that email saying, you can now officially become a member.
Yeah.
I signed up. I couldn't have signed up quicker. I couldn't have given them my money quicker.
Yeah.
And it was like moments later that we got another email saying, hey, ignore that. That was just Zara acting on a limb and don't listen to her and all that. I'm like, what the fuck? And then Zara released another statement saying they've been really mean to me and they've like had this sexist boys club and been shutting me out of proceedings. And I didn't do anything that wasn't agreed on when we first started. And my main reaction was, guys, why are you airing your dirty laundry like this? This is a, how can this even fucking happen. That one person can click a button and take people's money like that.
Well, yeah.
It was quite shocking.
I mean, I think they're all, both sides are worthy of blame, really. I mean, what she's tried to do, I think, is to, you know, I mean, that's the one of the things that you can say about Jeremy is he doesn't move fast, really.
Yes.
And so she's been by these unilateral declaration of that it was going to be joint leadership, and then by launching the membership portal, she's been attempting to kick him into action, really. Because if it was, I mean, he has.
Well, that's the case. It seemed to have worked because now Jeremy's announced the launch of the portal, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he should have done this. I mean, he should have launched the Left Party 3 years ago, really.
You've been saying it for months that he's like dragging his feet and talking to everyone in the country. And
I mean, it's a good, in a sense, you know, his inclinations to be consensual and
democratic
and talk to literally everybody and their cat. You know, is a good thing, but sometimes it's a bad thing when it results in paralysis, as it has been doing in this.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. You have to get a move on. There's a guy. I'm a member of Camden People's Alliance.
Yeah,
which is Andrew Feinstein.
Yeah.
And there's a guy who takes the minutes called Archie. I can't remember his second name, but he's got a very good article on the Novara site about the shenanigans, really. So if people want to know what's gone on so far, I think that's a good place to look, really. I mean, I suppose you can say, I mean, you know, the Greens or the Labour Party or whoever, they're formed by small groups of people and they grow. This is a party which is uniquely really trying to form itself in the bright spotlight of having, 800,000 people. You know, it's only clicking on a link, but nevertheless, you're trying to form a party from scratch while having this intense, while having potentially a massive membership from the get-go.
Yes.
And, you know, whereas most parties start out with very small membership and then they get to define themselves and their ideology and then they grow. This is a kind of reverse position.
They start with a small membership and a strong leadership.
Yeah.
So this extreme democracy approach that your party has done is indeed a double-edged sword approach because... Yeah, it's been slow and it's been fucking messy as hell.
I don't think that's because of the extreme democracy in all fairness. I think that's because of factional infighting. But it will be a big unwieldy beast if it is truly gonna never be democratic from the bottom.
But even beyond that, just some of the people involved or not involved, there's been discussions and disputes about that. But the positive side of it. This is the glimmer of hope I've taken away from this last week, is that the whole point they've been saying from the beginning is that when we launch in November, when we have our conference, it's you that are going to decide who the leaders are. We're not promising to be the leaders of the party. We're just trying to steward its launch, trying to steward its founding. You're going to decide who the leaders are. You're going to decide what our manifesto is. And that is just, I'm just waiting for that day. Once that comes into shape, then we can have something that we're going to truly stand behind, or we'll just go, you know what, I'm going to join the Green Party.
Well, we'll see. Yeah, we'll see to what extent that democracy is acted out in...
It could just get messy.
In the real world,
Yeah.
But, let's hope. But it's obviously as if we didn't leave enough. As we say in Yiddish, surus in our lives, we didn't need enough upset, with the genocide and, this should play out the way it has done so far is just, it's very difficult to handle, really. I think I'm sympathetic with people who, you know, and it, you know, have found it traumatic, really.
Yeah. And you can even kind of, there's nothing insidious going on, which I believe.
What do you mean by insidious?
Like nothing, everyone means well who's in there. You know?
Well, yeah. Maybe.
Well, at least Zara and Jeremy, I do believe they mean well. They're trying to create something.
Yeah. They're both good people. Yeah.
What's your doubts there?
No, it's just the partly the people, well, some of the people around them, I think, are not, may also be good people, but are not going to be effective in this process. I won't go into names, but, you know, I think them on, you know, that there are others involved who are complicating shit.
I don't like what I've heard about one of the geezers in Jeremy's crew.
No,
his position on trans rights and stuff.
I don't know whether you're going to get anywhere with these purity tests, though. You know, so anyway, that's all to be decided. So
you put anyone through the ringer, some shit's gonna fall out.
I think criteria for the membership of the party have got to be much broader. You know, you just got to agree to socialism, basically, what your views are on subjects within that, I think, are not necessarily relevant. You just got to be committed to equality and socialism and internationalism. I think you can't exclude people from the minutiae of, you know, beliefs.
Reading further into it now, it's not the worst stuff he said. I've heard a lot worse shit said. We got to build that foundation of socialism, and that's what makes them unique as well. I don't think Green Party are outwardly socialist.
I don't think they are. I mean, I think Polanski would call himself an eco-socialist, I think. But
yeah.
No, we will see. We will see. But also, I think there was also doubt about this, the membership saying you couldn't be a member of another party. I was at a meeting the other night. And that would mean that somebody said that Jeremy himself wouldn't be able to join your party because he's a member of the Beast and Justice Project, which is a party. So I don't know whether that's an attempt to not allow people, you know, in, like the Socialist Workers Party or the Communist Party or whatever, to be involved in this process. Oh, but I think that's something that people see that as a kind of roadblock.
Jeremy's planning on folding that in to your party.
Yeah. But anyway, that's another. There are obviously doctrinal, you know, there are immense complexities. I mean, it's not my area of expertise really, but there are areas of complexity that remain to be dealt with. But we will see.
Your area of expertise.
I think,
of course, being
pulling funny faces.
Hunter, fighter jet.
Yes. Weaponry.
That tank we mentioned. I've lost that tab now.
The Centurion. A fantastic tank.
I was at Thorpe Park yesterday.
Yes.
And I was wondering if there was an Alexi Land. What would be? So I was at Thorpe Park yesterday.
Banksy's dismal land.
Yeah, like dismal land. Yeah, what would be if you could design a Thorpe Park?
Well, I reached a friend
theme park.
When I was in LA once years ago, I was actually a relative of my friend. We were taken around the original Disneyland in Orange County by one of the people one of the designers who'd worked there, and he pointed out places where people have been killed Fuck. People had been dragged into the machinery of the Michael Jackson world. Oh, the those bears, those animatronic bears, had gone wild and torn people's heads off. But what the
that's what not the
Disney what Disney would do, of course, was off people massive compensation, and then would if they didn't, they would intimidate them if they didn't, if they shut up. If they tried to speak out about these deaths.
Fucking hell.
I think with the teacups, Alice's teacups was a ride, and one of them had come loose and flown across the theme park with people in it.
Jesus Christ.
But because they do have their own paramilitary police force, and this is also, I wrote one of my best short stories called Big Headed Cartoon Animal, which is about a theme park. And they are, because it's all connected by underground tunnels as well.
Yeah.
And like if you put your waste and rubbish bin, it drops straight down into one of these tunnels and they're taken away. And that's the way, because you never see food delivery trucks or anything, because it's all delivered underground to the
wow
the concessions.
As seen in Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Really?
Beverly Hills Cop 3. Yeah, it's set in a theme park.
And really?
He goes underground, runs around. Wow. Yeah.
There's one in the first two. This is, you know, film sequences where the first two are very good, and then the third one's terrible. I don't know whether it's a National Lampoon. I used to love National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and there's National Lampoon's Summer Vacation where they're going to Wally World, which is a kind of moose.
Yeah.
And they have adventures along the way. Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
But the third one, which I think I might have auditioned for, was they come to Europe. It's National Lampoon's European Vacation. And then it's staffed with people like Griffith Jones and Mel Smith and the people that, you know, English performers they'd hired of the era. And it's catastrophically bad. So is Beverly Hills Cop 3, is that bad?
No, it's fine.
Is it?
Yeah, it's good. That's a pretty solid trilogy. But this is, I've not seen it in years.
Yes. Yeah.
Goodness knows, I could be wrong. But I like it. No, there's a pretty thrilling scene where he's climbing up on the Ferris wheel and he's jumping from.
Still Eddie Murphy, is it?
Yeah, Eddie Murphy, yeah. And he's jumping from one, you know, what are they called on the Ferris wheels? The carriages.
Gondola, I think. Is
the... Yeah, he's jumping from one to the other to save this little kid. But the remake on Netflix is fucking god awful, or the fourth sequel.
Oh yeah, it's as much as everybody's old. Oh,
it's
fat
just embarrassing.
Yeah,
like why bother? It's just such a tiny budget. You can't live up to. It's just a nostalgia. Fucking just cashing in on people's nostalgia.
No, but we should talk in films. We should. I'm apologize. We're not looking at A Battle for Algiers this week because I haven't watched it yet. I've watched about. First 10 minutes and I haven't watched the rest of it.
Sorry, everyone at home.
Yeah, lo siento. I'm sorry.
We will get round to it
in
our own time. Thank you very much.
Sort of theme parks. If you go to, I think we're hoping to have Leia Yippie. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that, the Albanian, well, she teaches at the LSE, doesn't she? She teaches Marxism, author of a fantastic book, Free, which is about the collapse of communism in Albania. And she's got a new book out, and hopefully we're getting her on the podcast. But she, if you go to Tirana, there was a network of Enver Hoxha had built a network of blockhouses, pillboxes all over Albania, particularly in the capital. And some of those have been turned into kind of museums / theme parks. And so you can go down there and you can study the cells where people were tortured. And
slide down to the third floor to see where the secret police kept the records of everyone's parents.
Siggy Remy. Yeah, it's a kind of theme park of failed Marxism, Leninism. Jesus. Unique feature of Tirana. We went to one of them. It was very claustrophobic. It's very narrow corridors, and it was too full of tourists, really. I have to say I didn't really like it much. But
Alexi Land.
What would it be? Well, I suppose it'd be a historical journey through. There'd be Talal cartoon figures and Alexi. It'd be just a trip through my history. Wouldn't it start off with the Comedy Store, recreation of Comedy Store, 1979, and then the comic strip, BBC Studios, of see a recording of, recreation of a recording of Stuff.
Yeah.
Or the Young Ones, and then, you know.
Oh, you have to have holograms of Bobby Chariot giving little tour
Bobby,
guides.
Yeah, people playing Bobby, that'd be really good, yeah.
Oh, yeah, actors, character actors running around as Bobby.
On pills for me.
And signing little kids' autograph books.
Yeah, yeah, no, that'd be good. And then through, yeah, through the 1990s, Alexis Hale in his Armani suit, realising he's gone out of fashion.
What about rides? What kind of ride would you like?
Yeah, well, we could ride in, you could like my Rover P5B coupe. You could have that could be mounted on a kind of roller coaster and people could ride.
And it stops every 50 meters. It
breaks
stops.
Down, yeah. An RAC man comes out and says, great cars, these. So, yeah, well, why am I stuck at fucking Lee Delamere Services then if it's such a great fucking car?
And it gets push started by 50 hippies.
Hippies, could recreate 1980s Glastonbury.
You'd have to have a tank, little tank world in there as well or something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true. They could have their first, the Bovington Tank Museum, they could have their, like a branch at Alexi World, yeah.
Oh, you know, in Legoland, little kids can get their driver's license. They have a little city built and you drive in a Lego car, get your driver's license. You get your tank license at Alexiland.
Yeah, and of course, all the catering would be done by Alexis Hale's imaginary sandwich bar. It'd be a recreation of a 1970s sandwich bar.
Just hundreds
industrial
of
qualities of
people.
Coronation chicken and steak and kidney pies and chips and beans at 1980s prices.
Oh, yes.
Rainbow pudding. Spotted dick.
Amazing.
Egg mayonnaise. Yeah.
You could have an Indiana Jones ride in there.
Yeah, we could do that. We'd do that. And
I like
up to today. Yeah.
I like the sound of that.
It doesn't sound too bad, does it? It sounds like it.
It started off rocky, but then we got some rides in there and now I'm...
Yeah.
Now it's actually sounding more like a theme park. That's great.
Yeah. 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 What we talk about next?
People at home, send in your drawings of Alexiland.
Oh,
send
that's
in your
true.
Concept
I also,
art.
Yeah. I also had a big shout out to Sufyan. At the big Palestinian benefit at the Troxy. Why wasn't I at the one in Wembley? People are asking. A man bid £1,000 for a pint with Alexis Hale.
Mm-hmm.
Sufyan.
Sufyan, you pronounce
Sufyan.
It.
That's you said? Sufyan.
Yeah.
Won it, but because he's Muslim, he doesn't really drink. He's from Qatar, but we went and had a very nice tea. We went to the Delaunay counter on the Aldwych and had coffee and tea and apple strudel. And scones, and we had a lovely chat. But he also owns. He's the owner of one of the Alexi Lego figures as well.
Yeah, he bought the last one of them, the auction. And all that donated to. He paid hundreds of pounds for it. All donated to medical aid for Palestinians. You know, it's not really fair in these auctions, these charity auctions, when a Gulfie strolls into the chat.
Well, it's still.
It's like, well, it's yeah, you're going to win.
Yeah. Well, he's not like a super rich sheikh or anything. He was very nice. We had a very nice chat.
That's really nice. Shout out to you, Sufyan.
Yeah.
Contributing to the cause.
Yeah.
Fan of the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he studied, you told me he studied here in the 80s and that's how he got into you.
Yeah.
He's a big Alexi fan.
Yeah, he'd seen the Young Ones, I think, when he was over here in the 80s. And yeah, he's been a fan ever since. And he was saying, you know, come out and do stand-up in there. You know, they apparently do stand-up shows now where it's not just, I know there's always been an expat circuit for comedians in the Gulf, in Abu Dhabi and... Doha and Bahrain and stuff. But now there's a, obviously the more Anglophone locals come along as well.
Well, yeah, man.
That's not going to work.
Well, I don't know, because, like, you know, the locals in, you know, the Emirates and Saudi, they want to be westernized. You know, they love Western culture and they love absorbing it, consuming it. And it also helps them become more worldly and you know, relate and do business with Americans and Brits more if they're more in tune with the culture. But it brings them joy.
Yeah.
Arabic comedians, Arabic stand-up in particular, because obviously there's been comedy in the Middle East since forever, and it's there's some brilliant comedy out there, but the art of stand-up comedy is a very Western thing. It's a very American and British thing. So they are still learning the true art of that. And there's always been in Dubai, you know, even the comedy night I'm most affiliated with, Arabs Are Not Funny, they've taken the show over to Dubai a couple times, but it's never been like government sponsored, you know.
Yeah, but aren't there still limits on what you can say?
You have to tone it down a bit. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
I think the punishment is a bit less harsh in the Emirates than it would be in Saudi. But I have had some messages on our Patreon asking you what your opinion is on this latest Riyadh in Saudi, Riyadh Comedy Festival.
Yeah, I don't know.
Which it's a government-funded comedy festival. And they've brought over a slew of Western. Let me just bring it up here on my monitor.
Name some names.
A slew of Western comedians are going there. 50 global comedians heading to Riyadh Comedy Festival 2025. Dave Chappelle's doing it. Jeff Ross, Gabriel Iglesias. These are the Americans. And then you've got Jim Owen, very funny guy. Omid Jalili is going. Oh my God, Aziz Ansari used to be cancelled. Now he seems to be resurfacing. Yeah. Kevin Hart, Tom Segura. So none of these, Andrew Schultz, you know, a lot of these you just expect to do it.
Yeah.
But then you've got people like Bill Burr, Maz Jobrani, and Omid, who I'd be like, I thought you would.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how. Obviously, the cultural, cultural boycotts, we need to start with Israel. Obviously, the Israel, and that's something that is proceeding apace, and it's good to see, because Israel is actively engaged in the genocide, and it must be. You know, I mean, I've been a long time, probably founding member of the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions, and I am very proud to be so, and I think that needs to carry on. But I'm also, you know, I did a bit in Sandwich Bar about it. The sports washing that goes on with Saudi Arabia, obviously them buying like Newcastle United and this stuff like we're seeing here. If that was linked to a kind of loosening of, you know, if the problem is that all this sports washing and comedy washing does not signify a loosening of the extraordinary cruelty of the Saudi regime, as I understand it. Exactly. I mean, there's still that, you know, for instance, they allowed women to drive eventually, but then the women who'd campaigned for it, had been most prominent, are still, as far as I know, in being held in unbelievably cruel.
Yeah.
Imprisonment.
And they're only allowed to drive under 40 miles per hour and they have their own lanes.
Really? No. I didn't know that. Oh, right. I believed you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the road they had to go down to get that. And
And it's savage. And of course, there's the case of Khashoggi, who was chopped, you know, went to get his marriage visa or whatever it was at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, and then was chopped up while alive by a Saudi
secret service.
Muhabarat, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was all recorded on his Fitbit watch.
Fuck.
Which is how we learned about it. But I think there's no, Mohammed bin Salman has not backed off from any of that shit. It's Saudi Arabia is as restrictive for women and, you know, for dissent as it ever was. So it's not. So I think really you are giving, I mean, I say that our main enemy, you know, I mean, because Israel is us, Israel is the West, we have to concentrate on Israel. You know,
we're not, Saudi also we're going not, ahead yeah. and trying to normalize relations yeah. with Israel, and they're not yeah. They could have a big part in stopping Israel, they what could. They're doing, they not could. Doing nothing yeah. about
no.
it.
No, no. I mean, and we are, I mean, in a sense, we are, I think we are. Somebody I was looking at on the, you know, said, you know, all problems in the world come back to Britain, really. Ultimately, we're responsible for all the bad things in the world. If you go far back, you know, I mean, obviously the Balfour Declaration and the founding of the State of Israel, and that's our fault, you know.
Yeah.
The, you know, the brutal partition of India and Pakistan, that's all our fault. I mean, the United States is our fault, really, since it was founded by people who were so unpopular in Britain that they had to sail across the Atlantic. So everything's our fault. And certainly Saudi Arabia, I think, is our fault in the redrawing of the map after collapse of the Ottoman Empire, after the collapse of the First World War, really, and the installation of this cruel, the dynasty in Saudi Arabia, that's our fault. So I, you know, I mean, not that they would, you know, I mean, I think they probably know. I mean, I'm sure they don't care if I, you know, if I'm there or not, but I think you are, if you go to Saudi Arabia or if you play for a Saudi sports team or join in a Saudi sponsored golf tournament, you are helping to cover up massive cruelty. Which, as far as I know, again, if anybody knows any better, it's not lessening, really, but it goes on much as it's always done, really.
You're condoning it. You're condoning it all, at the very least.
Yeah.
You know, you're saying, I don't mind. I didn't mention the biggest night at the Riyadh Comedy Festival, headlined by a celebrant of the Israeli Embassy's 60th anniversary, was it? The host of their party was Jimmy Carr.
Yes, at the British Museum.
Co-headlining with him is probably history's best stand-up, but also massive pervert, Louis C.K.
Not a massive pervert, just a pervert. I'm still a fan. He's funny, he has got work. I mean, I've seen some of his stuff. He's not the comic he was either, really. I mean,
it's undeniable how hilarious and genius his comedy is, but, you know, bringing, you know, small-time female comics into the green room and wanking off in front of them is fucking gross and,
and
cruel.
Yeah.
Very cruel abuse of power. And
absolutely.
He kind of deserved all the fucking punishment he got for that.
It's a real shame. I was terribly upset by that, really. I did love him as a comic, really.
They're co-headlining on October 6th.
Jimmy Carr and fucking...
Think of the censorship they'll have to do to their
sets.
Also,
Louis, I mean... Yeah, I mean, there's so much wrong with that. It's hard to know where to begin, isn't it, really?
Mm.
Jimmy Carr was very nice to me the one time I met him, I have to say, but then, you know, he would be, I suppose.
Where did you meet Jimmy Carr?
I think it was that photo. I think it was that. I think it was something. Dawn French did this series called Boys Who Are Funny or something. I think it was a photo shoot for that or something. I know Dawn was there and. Jimmy Carr was there. Before he had his, you know, he's had so much extensive facial surgery. I think they're showing my, are they showing my arena documentary?
Yes.
It's quite good that in part, there's a song I do, which is a bit painful, I think,
What, Hello, John Got a New Motor?
No, it's not that. It's called Road. No, it's...
What's the show? Tell us about the Arena documentary.
Arena is a documentary strand, which I don't think is still going. On BBC, it was usually on BBC Two, And there was a kind of group of mavericks within the BBC, headed by Alan Yentob, late Alan Yentob, Nigel Finch, late Nigel Finch, Anthony Wall, Mary Dickinson, great directors. And they did really interesting documentaries. The famous one, the two most famous ones from the 80s, I think, in My Way, and the Cortina documentary, which is something like the most watched documentary of all time, is presented. Mm. Essentially presented by me. My manager at the time failed to get me a credit. I should have got a writing credit on the film, but I didn't, through managerial inefficiency. But it's really interesting piece of work.
And what,
I think they're re-showing it. I don't know. It sounded like you'd seen something.
Well, yeah, I was just trying to get you to explain it.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think is it the anniversary of Arena or something? So I caught a bit of Anthony Wall talking about Arena.
Yeah, so as part of the Arena season on BBC Four, it looks like they've already aired it because I can't find a showtime for it. But it is on iPlayer. It's come back up on iPlayer. Arena, The Private Life of the Ford Cortina. Hosted by Alexis Sale.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it looks like things are heating up for Israel, to be fair. The world isn't taking it lightly that they've been attacking this freedom flotilla.
Right.
They've like been sending drones over there. So there's the global Samud flotilla. They've sent about 50 boats full of aid and social media influencers over to Gaza to break the blockade and get aid in there. But it's the meaning behind it is so much more than the small amount of aid that they could possibly get through. There's a bigger message and a bigger point they're making, which I think is really fucking beautiful. Now, our friend Tig is on one of those boats. A couple of people that we met when we were shooting with Tig that one day a few months ago, they're on the boats. We, of course, solidarity and support to all of those fucking heroes. I wish I was on there with them. I really do.
Spain and Italy have sent warships, and we should really be sending one of our crappy destroyers.
It's really heating up, man. I don't know. Every now and then you think, oh, the tide is turning, the message is turning, the narrative is changing.
Mm.
But things are actually happening here because, you know, Israel, a drone from Yemen just got through and attacked Israel, you know.
Yeah.
Not celebrating any fucking deaths or anything, but that's quite... But the biggest thing in the last week has been all these countries recognizing the state of Palestine as well. Any thoughts on that, Alexei?
Well, I think it's largely performative. I mean, Keir Starmer is fighting tooth and nail to do absolutely nothing to, and genocide or end Israeli apartheid. So I think you have to see it in that context. Nevertheless, it might, you know, there are also, there's votes to ban Israel from FIFA, from the European.
Yeah. And Eurovision and then Eurovision. The UEFA. Yeah.
And I think once that genie is out the bottle, as it were, you can't put it back in. So that, you know, it's painfully slow, and obviously the United States is fighting it every step of the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there is a growing rift between Europe. You know, there's been a general strike. It's been not been mentioned on the stinking BBC.
In Italy.
There's been a general strike in Italy for several days now in support of Gaza.
Yeah.
Not as far as I've not seen it mentioned at all on the British media, but it's a really
big thing. They
don't
want to give us any ideas, do they?
Yeah. And so that, you know, I mean, it's the horrors continue day after day, but I think that once Israel's isolation is achieved, and then that, you know, there's no going back. People have seen what Israel is, this ethno-fascist apartheid state, and that knowledge cannot be taken away again. Mm-hmm. I sincerely hope so. You know, I mean, it's all that is good, really. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'd be interested. Because these boats are in international waters and being attacked by Israel. I mean, there was a boat from Turkey, wasn't it, 10 years ago, the Mavi Marmara, which was boarded by Israeli commandos. And they killed 9 Turkish citizens, I think they were.
Jesus.
Without a murmur from Western nations. I don't know if they could get away with that kind of shit anymore, really. And it is interesting. I mean, the British bloody Navy should be there as well, protecting. I think these ships are registered as British.
Some of them are, yeah.
In the last flotilla, they were registered as British vessels. And so this is piracy, what Israel is doing. And we should be out there protecting our ships.
We're obliged to. We should be, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be for the first time in history, one of those Type 46 destroyers actually be doing something useful.
But it is, it's very nice to see that Spain and Italy are stepping up.
Yeah,
in that,
I mean, Spain's been really good.
Of course.
Relatively good throughout, you know.
But performative or not, all these countries recognizing the state of Palestine does, like, lawfully add interesting things into the mix, doesn't it? Because now it's not just Israel acting against its own population. Now, on paper, they are attacking another state, another country, right? And doesn't that add some interesting...
I don't know. I mean, you know, it was already recognized by 140 odd nations. It didn't really seem to make any difference. I mean, one of the things that paralyzes things is that veto at the Security Council. So the United States, you know, the United Nations is paralyzed by the United States' veto at the Security Council. I think you got to find a way around that, really. That would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And there's this plan now that Tony Blair is going, I mean, it's also the Palestinian Authority themselves and nothing to write home about. They're corrupt.
Yeah. Oh, mate, he wants a two-state solution, which is so heartbreaking. He's like, I'm willing to discuss two-state solution. Oh, my dude. Have some
Jesus
backbone.
Abbas.
Have some backbone, yeah.
How old is he now? He's in good nick because he's in his 90s, isn't he? Full head of hair. Give him that. We'll see. I mean, it's painful. I mean, it's painfully slow, but the situation vis-a-vis Palestine does seem to be changing. How many more people will have to die? Children be murdered before. There's a resolution, I don't know, but it's people freely use the word genocide now, I think, on the media, even though the BBC says, well, Israel denies the genocide. I mean, again, they probably won't do it, but I heard the son of Mustafa Kharkouti, Barghouti, I don't know if a relative of you, the Palestinian Mandela, if there is one, is a guy called Mustafa Barghouti, who's been imprisoned by the Israelis, I think, for the last 20 years and tortured, and I think he's probably not in a good way now. But he is the one many people in Palestine support him more than Hamas, more than Palestinian Authority. If he could somehow, if he's still functioning and could be allowed, he could be a unifying figure if he could be released from prison. But I know his son was talking, his son was called Arab Barghouti, was talking on the BBC and freely using the word genocide. And the BBC did afterwards, did afterwards say, Israel would, of course, deny these allegations. But he was allowed to speak frankly about his father's torture and about genocide, and if somehow he could be released, he would be a unifying figure, I think, for the Palestinian struggle. But that's probably the reason why he will never be released. There's footage of him, last time he was seen was when I think one of those fuckers, it's either Smotrich or Ben-Gavir, was shouting at him in his cell. He was allowed to go into his cell and he looked very frail and ill, and he has clearly been tortured. That's your Israel for you, Jimmy Carr, that's your Israel. For you, Maureen Lipman, that's your Israel. Rachel Riley, torturing a unifying figure.
Anyone with any platform, any common sense, any intelligence. It's like when the Nazis killed anyone with glasses, you know, because they thought that meant they were an intellectual.
I think you're conflating the Khmer Rouge and the Nazis. I don't think the Nazis killed people with glasses. The Khmer Rouge did.
Forgive me. But if you're an intellectual, you can see beyond the hypocrisy and the injustice, and that makes you a threat, you know.
Yeah.
Mahmoud Abbas is 89 years old.
89.
Fuck me. Get him out.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You can't be that old. And he looks like Jabba the fucking Hutt.
He's got a good nick for 89, but, I mean, he shouldn't be there, you know. No.
Jesus Christ.
No, they're awful.
Two-state solutions, people love the sound of it, but it will never bring peace. It can't. It literally can't, because if you have a two-state solution, there will always be people who can't go back to their homes. There will always be people whose land has been taken.
I can't see. I mean, I suppose you could have all the, you know, the settlers could stay there and just be ruled by the Palestinians. They could be citizens of a Palestinian state. Why expel them from those settlements? Just incorporate them into the state of Palestine. They can stay there, Jewish, no reason why. Yeah. People of all religions can't live in Palestine. So that could be one way that you could have a Palestinian state. I think you just want the killing to stop for now, really, and then
absolutely
deal with that sort of shit later. But
please, for God's sake, please.
Yeah.
Well, let's see what happens in the next week, man. A lot has happened this week. We'll be in Shoreham. It's sold out.
That's a bit more fucking sprightly than this.
Yes. It's a pretty low tempo show today.
Hey?
Low tempo, relaxed show.
I always come today. Alive. I generally come alive in front of an audience. So don't I mean.
Yeah.
Hey, it was all right.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Nice chat. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's always nice to round off my week with a nice chat with Alexi Sale. And I hope that listeners at home feel the same way. If you want to support what we do, please go to patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast and throw a few quid our way per month. You'll get access to the full video episodes of our podcast. You'll get access to Alexi, Lisa, and Nigel watching The Young Ones. Have I put it out yet? No, I haven't. Fuck. Episode 2 coming out imminently. And you get to join this lovely community in the chat room and ask questions to Alexi and myself, and you might get it read out on air. That's patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast. Follow us at AlexiSalePod on all the socials. Email AlexiSalePodcast@gmail.com. If you have a question or some fan art, send us your artwork of Alexi World, Alexi Land. That's the plugs done. Thank you for this, Lex.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sale Podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.